Good morning. The political and logistical fallout from the Malaysia air crash continued throughout the week, with accusations that the policing of the site in this remote region of Ukraine by a raggle-taggle army of rebels was chaotic and lawless. The Boeing 777 aircraft, believed to have been brought down by a surface-to-air missile, spread over an area of 25 miles. 298 people lost their lives, including Irish woman Adele Mahady. And far from being a forensically pure and hermetically sealed crime scene, there's been pilfering from the crash site and tampering with evidence. Matt Fry was on the ground in the war zone reporting for Channel 4, and he described the distressing scenes on Morning Ireland.
Try to imagine beyond the kind of horrific event itself, you know, the circumstances in which those corpses are now lying, the circumstances in which their belongings, you know, are festering out in the field. And of course, every belonging, however mundane it might seem, is a sacred reminder to the loved ones of their existence. Now, how do you deal with that stuff? And, you know, will it all be collected? Will it be given to the right people at the end of the day? I mean, I'll give you a small example. We saw yesterday a girl's holiday diary, which is lying on the ground, and a Dutch journalist looked at it and said, I'm not going to leave this here, even though I know I should not be tampering with the evidence. I'm not going to leave this book here, because if I do, the rain will wash away the writing, the book will get moldy, and it will be destroyed. And that is one of the most precious things, that the family of that girl will hold on to that as one of the most precious reminders of their child. So I think, you know, it's a difficult judgment call, but I think in that case it was absolutely the right thing to do.
Matt Fry. Of the 298 people on board flight MH17, 193 of them were Dutch. Their bodies were flown to Eindhoven and onto the military barracks at Hilversum for forensic examination, and a national day of mourning was observed on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the two black boxes from the airliner were handed over by the rebels to Malaysian investigators and were taken to Farnborough in England for analysis. Jürgen White is chief inspector of air accidents in this country, and he spoke with Rachel English on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
The Malaysian authorities have asked the UK Air Accident Investigation Branch to analyse that. And in fact, last night I was talking to the team that were escorting the recorders to Farnborough in the UK. So they have been working through the night, and they will start listening to the cockpit voice recorder, and they will analyse the flight data recorder.
What sort of information do they contain?
Well, the cockpit voice recorder is basically on a continuous basis recording the conversations and transmissions that are in the cockpit. It's a 2-hour loop recording, and they would expect to be listening to the conversation of the pilots as they go along. Now, regards to the CVR, there are two aspects. If the aircrew were dealing with an emergency, it's likely that they would hear that discussion on board the aircraft, and they would know that they were dealing with a problem. If that's not the case, and if people are having a normal conversation and then things go quiet, obviously something catastrophic has taken place. They will then move to the flight data recorder, which is basically recording the parameters of the aircraft. If everything is working properly, if the engines are working properly, and then there is a sudden stop of information going to recorder, it means that a catastrophic event has taken place.
So that while then these boxes are very important, there's lots they don't tell us too.
Yes, you cannot be guaranteed that will provide the golden nugget, as we say. So they will be looking at everything. They will be looking at air traffic control tapes, radar tapes, satellite imagery. They'll be analysing the recorders, and they'll be looking at the wreckage. So it's a jigsaw of evidence that they're putting together.
Jürgen White, heard on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Well, Rory McIlroy has been wowing us on and off the fairways following his 2-shot victory at Hoylake on Merseyside last weekend, his third major. The newly crowned Open champion spoke with RTE's Greg Allen after his victory.
It feels incredible. I just feel like all the hard work that I've put in has paid off.
You had the birdie in the first hole, 7 clear, 17 holes to play. It's almost preordained that you win from there, but you made it quite interesting.
I didn't mean to. Didn't mean to make it interesting. You know, bogey in the par 5, 5th hole, and then, you know, compounding that error with a bogey at 6. You know, that's when I really had to steady the ship, and, you know, it was a great up and down on 7. And then the birdie on 9 was huge. The birdies on 9 and 10 were massive for me, just to give me a little bit of a cushion again, especially when Sergio was pushing me all the way and made eagle on 10. So, you know, those two birdies on 9 and 10 were crucial. And then whenever I made birdie on 16, I knew that was pretty much it. To go into the final 2 holes 3 ahead, I thought that, you know, that was where I won the Open.
You had this inner calm that you spoke about over the first few days. It was challenged today, big time. How did you cope with those wobbles?
just the same as I did the first few days. You know, I felt very, very calm inside. I knew I still had a bit of a gap, a bit of a cushion, and I kept just telling myself, you know, just hit your shots, you know, stick to what you're doing, you know, execute your game plan, and if you can do that, then everything will be okay.
Rory, you're cradling the claret jug as I'm speaking to you. It's in your hands. You're looking at all the names in the trophy. What does it feel like to fulfill the dream of every child who plays golf in Ireland, north or south?
It's absolutely incredible. Just to, you know, I'm going to have a good study of it tonight whenever I get back to the house. But even to see my name on there already, and you know, with all the great players in the world, and you know, it's my third major. It's my third different major. You know, I'm one away from the career Grand Slam. So, oh, it's just been a it's been an incredible week, and you know, it hasn't quite sunk in yet, as it shouldn't, but you know, I'm really going to enjoy tonight with my friends and family and let it sink in.
Rory McIlroy with Greg Allen on Monday. Well, it's been a cracking campaign for the Irish women's under-19 soccer team, already dubbed the History Girls for their heroic victories over the top three seeds in the tournament. They bowed out of the European Championship semi-finals on Thursday night against the Netherlands.
Sometimes in sport, a defeat shouldn't mask an overall performance, and that certainly would apply to the Republic of Ireland under-19's women's team. They were beaten in the European Championship semi-finals last night. They lost 4-0 to the Netherlands in Oslo, which obviously was very disappointing. The Dutch will now face Spain in the final, but to keep it in context, Ireland have already beaten Spain and England and Sweden. It's been a great campaign. A top four finish in Europe is a fantastic achievement for the Irish.
Des Cahill. And of course, all roads will lead to Thurles tomorrow for Wexford fans, Limerick fans, Tipperary fans and Dublin fans for the senior hurling quarterfinals. Well, 2 years ago, Gardaí in Limerick told publican Steve Collins that he and his family had no option but to go into a witness protection programme and emigrate. This a direct result of the intimidation and abuse they suffered over 10 years at the hands of the notorious McCarthy-Dundon criminal gang. A shocking price to pay just for standing up to them. Last week in the special criminal court, Wayne Dundon and Nathan Killeen were given mandatory life sentences for their part in the murder of Steve's son, Roy, who was shot dead 5 years ago. Steve Collins was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
You had a fine, thriving business.
Yeah.
Your business was wiped out.
Wiped out. My life had changed so much, like, Marion, that I was being followed by two armed Gardaí. My two sons had two armed Gardaí following them on. I was going around in bulletproof vests. I mean, the list of things like that happened to us, like the murder of Roy, the maiming of Ryan. That guy came in, shot him in the knee and blew his knee away nearly, and then came back and shot him again and left him for dead, like. And then they burned down our pub, you know, Brannigan's, burned it to the ground, destroyed that business, you know. They put pipe bombs at the back of our other pub, you know, which scared all the customers. We had a constant run of dry runs of coming into the pub, you know, and running out, just checking the response of the Gardaí, you know, to see where they on the ball, like, you know, watching us, like, you know. Sending kids up on BMX bikes and skidding outside the front door, like, just because you were standing there, just to intimidate you.
And when you say kids, you mean kids?
Oh, I mean kids, yeah. I mean, they had all these little 12-year-olds, like, you know, going around on bikes, but, you know, intimidating you. Like, it does, it scares you. Like, I was more afraid, to be honest with you, of those kids coming up to me than I was of ever Wayne Dundon coming near me, like, you know.
Really?
Really, I was, yeah, because I know the way they put their arms around these vulnerable kids. Like, I mean, they're coming from poor areas, like, and they haven't seen much, and the likes of Wayne Dundon then putting his arm around them, saying there's a life of bling, and you do this and you become a member. And I mean, they're so easy to turn them, like. And then they dug a grave for me, just a couple of hundred yards away from the thing that I didn't know was for me, like, you know.
It must have been nerve-wracking to sit in court as Judge Isolt O'Malley read out the summary of the evidence in the Marathon murder trial. Marion wondered if Steve was worried that the evidence of those who testified against Dundon and Killeen, many of them criminal gang associates and relations, wouldn't be believed by the judge.
Now, as you were sitting in the court listening to all of this, she threw out some, obviously, of Gareth Collins, discounted April Collins, discounted another Collins. Did you for any moment at all think, dear Lord, could this not succeed?
It was a rollercoaster ride, like, really, like, you know, during the reading of the verdict, the first that Killeen would be found guilty because of the DNA, the gun residue, the CCTV footage, the evidence against him was very, you know, it was strong, like, you know.
Yeah.
But Dundon's, like, on the other hand, he wasn't so clear-cut, like, him after disregarding all these witnesses. And she was upset about the stunt with Nadi McCarthy,
yes,
that he had pulled, like, in court. So I thought, like, that it ruined his evidence. It was getting very, very upsetting at that stage to be thinking that he was going to get away. But at the end of her summing up, like, she took his evidence to be credible, that he had nothing to gain from all this, like, only misery.
And why did she throw out the other evidence?
Well, there was a lot of lawyers came into it. There was a couple of lawyers that were caught out on,
Yeah.
It just wasn't safe enough. She felt that even though some of it she thought was credible, most of it wasn't safe enough that she could use it, like, you know. And so she threw it out. I mean, it's probably better that she did, like, because you don't want these people coming back getting away on some silly appeal, like, you know.
Do you feel safe?
Well, I do today, no, Marion, to be honest, because I haven't up to now, like, you know, but it was a tough thing to have to go away from your home and that.
And despite all that's happened, Steve Collins says that he'd like to return with his family to live in Limerick again if they can get security clearance from Gardaí, from the Marion Finucane show last Saturday. Well, like many others, I remember the day in October 1971 when composer Sean O'Riordan died. Sean's life was lived hard and full, and he left a legacy of sublime music, both traditional and classical. His work cut short by an early death at the age of 40. He left behind a young widow, Ruth O'Riordan, who died herself 5 years later, and a family of seven young children. Well, Miriam O'Callaghan visited the family at their home in the Coolay Gaeltacht last Sunday, and she spoke with Leon O'Riordan, recently elected Sinn Féin MEP, Pather, who's a composer and musician, and Rachel, who's cultural officer with Uthros. Miriam asked about the difficulties they faced when they were orphaned at such a young age.
Having lost both my parents by the age of 10, it would certainly have made me terribly independent. And the legacy of Sean O'Riordan lives on. And, you know, that legacy for me, I suppose, would be having that sense of our Irish identity and having that grow for who we are as a people. And that would have been very important for me. So the richness of the legacy lives on, even though we lost out hugely from a young family's perspective.
And the nice thing, Rachel, is that when both of your parents did die, because I think they died, was it 5 years apart?
Yes.
You managed to stay together as a family.
Well, we did. You know, as Leah says, it was very difficult at the time and probably, you know, very difficult to talk about it still, to be quite honest. But we had great neighbours. I was still living locally. I got married the year my mother died, just a fortnight after my mother died, in fact. But I was very much aware that the younger members of the family were living a mile away from where I was and that I wasn't able to be hands-on. You know, we just struggled too. We just had to do it. You have to deal with these things.
In the earlier years, the press used to come a lot and say, oh, isn't it awful and it's sad and da-di-da-di-da, and we'd have to trot out all these lines. We were never nasty to anyone. Mm-hmm. That we tried to be uasal, which is what our father taught us, which means be noble, which means be truthful, mm-hmm, and be generous. We survived and thrived, and it's thanks to the material that we're made of, which came from both our parents.
He was only 40 when he died. My mother was only 47 when she died. And really, being at that age myself, you kind of get a grasp of the enormity of what he achieved, and I suppose what my mother achieved as well in that very short life.
Share my heart, give them.
Shea Muleach McGillamar, sung by Cor Coulet with Sean O'Shea and heard on Sunday with Miriam. Orla Tinsley is best known in this country as a successful campaigner for special hospital facilities for those living with cystic fibrosis. Orla herself is only too familiar with the limitations the disease puts on a sufferer, but over the past few months, she's been part of a trial for a new drug to treat the underlying causes. It's a combination of lumacaftor and ivacaftor, and while this is not a cure, she still has to take her meds every day and stick to her treatment regime, it's given her a better quality of life and some hope, as she told Sean O'Rourke on Monday.
Since January, I have seen incredible improvements in my own life, and it's been a slow burner, but, you know, it's undeniable, the changes.
What happened? What are the changes?
Well, so far, I think it was actually around March, around my birthday, when I realised I haven't been sick since January. You know, in January, I had a very severe flu. I was in hospital for about 3-4 weeks and I was very sick. And then I started on the actual drug and I stayed out of hospital until June, which was the first time I had that length of time out of hospital since I was about 5 or 6 years old. So that says an awful lot.
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic. And you know, it wasn't just being out of hospital. It was the energy that I had as well. It's a wild kind of feeling to suddenly be able to commit to things like socially and professionally, and to realise that you actually have all this time and your life isn't going to be continuously interrupted by illness. And it even makes you think about the way you see life. You know, it's fascinating.
You were able to plan and do things that you hadn't been able to do before, like some travelling?
Yes, I was. Yes, I am. I went travelling to the Cystic Fibrosis European Conference to give a talk. And what was remarkable about that trip was that I was travelling through constant 20 degree heat. And normally, since my late teens, that would really affect my lungs. And I took a chance with it because I'd been feeling so well. And I found after, say, 48 hours in that heat that it wasn't bothering me. Like, I wasn't breathless like I normally would be. I wasn't feeling unwell. I was able to carry my suitcase and my backpack and travel like normal, whatever normal is, you know. And it was just the most incredible feeling. This drug is the closest thing to a miracle for cystic fibrosis. And it's not a cure, but, you know, it's the first step towards it.
And there'll be no stopping this fantastic young woman, Orla Tinsley, who's off on a scholarship to Columbia University in New York to study creative writing. Another person not daunted by a disability is explorer and adventurer Robert Dowdall, whose memoir, Beyond the Darkness, has just been published. Robert went blind at 18 following a car crash. On medical advice, he went to Torquay in England for specialist training to regain his independence. And as he told John Murray, it took falling in love with an older woman while there to bring him out of himself.
She was twice my age and she seemed beyond the blindness. And if anything, it was a brilliant friendship at first. She brought me on myself emotionally, big time. Let go, like, she dropped a lot of baggage with me. Because at 18, being blinded, I'd never be with a girl again. You know that type of attitude? I must admit I did fall in love with her, yeah. In an emotional sense, it really brought me forward, you know. I began to believe in myself again. So, yeah, of course. It was great fun. She got me driving, believe it or not. She was the first one to get me behind the wheel of a car. It was brilliant on the beach.
And you've climbed the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro. That must have been a buzz.
I'd say, of them all, that was the hardest challenge I ever had. Because it's a freestanding mountain, you're not up and down like the Himalayas. You're just up, 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 up. And we done it in 4 days. And, yeah, it was tough.
And there was a lot of celebrating when you got to the top.
Absolutely. And when we got back down. The big celebration was when we got back down. The Sherpas, the guides, like they were singing. And I just knew they were paying homage to me and the mountain. And I felt so humbled and a part of it. It was just unreal. They put me on their shoulders. And, yeah, there was a few tears shed that night, all right.
From the John Murray Show on Tuesday. Dubliner Jack Gleeson, who played King Joffrey in the TV series Game of Thrones, is one of the most successful Irish actors in the world, up there with Colin Farrell, Cillian Murphy, Brendan Gleeson and Chris O'Dowd. But earlier this year, he announced his retirement from the glitz and the glamour at the grand old age of 22, underwhelmed, he said, by the culture of celebrity. Well, Jack's acting career really took off while he was studying at Trinity College, collaborating with love-hate actor Aaron Heffernan, writer Owen Quinn and director Dan Colley. And they've teamed up again, this time with a production called Bears in Space. Well, Jack Gleeson and director Dan Colley were John Murray's guests on Tuesday.
And what are you studying, by the way?
Philosophy and theology.
And why are you studying it?
Why? I mean, that's the perennial question, isn't it? Why? That's exactly why.
Tell us why.
Yeah, it's exactly these kind of contributions in the rehearsal room that makes him such a star.
Yes, it is.
Frustrating. Maybe.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll hold the stand somewhere and he'll ask me why, Dan.
Are all his friends delighted?
Well, Dan studied philosophy as well. So
oh, I see. So what about Jack? Has he changed as a result of his role in one of the biggest TV series of all time?
Yeah, he has changed. Yeah, he's a lot meaner. He's more willing to cut out people's tongues, that kind of thing. Yeah.
A nasty friend.
But no, I think pretty much the opposite. Jack's always been Jack. And, you know, I worked with him as a director, as a collaborator, before he was in Game of Thrones and after he was in Game of Thrones.
You knew me when I was just a normal guy.
I did, yeah. Well, he was just as difficult to work with on both sides of that experience, it has to be said.
Sarcastic.
Nothing has changed, though.
Nothing has changed, yeah. I mean, I was laughing earlier on because he's calling himself a perfectionist, you know, and that would be maybe a credit to you if you learned your lines.
True, which is something I need to do because the show we're releasing
tell us about
tomorrow.
Tell us, Dan. Do you want to tell us?
Bears in Space, which features our very own Jack Gleeson.
And Aaron Heffernan and Anne Quinn and Cameron McCauley.
That's right. Jack very much in the supporting role, but then everybody's sort of supporting each other, I think. Bears in Space is a comedy show. The subtitle is Bears That Are in Space, so you might be able to guess what it's about.
It's about the banking crisis in Vienna.
It's not
in
Jack,
the
it's about Bears
century.
In Space, actually.
It is, yeah.
Jack Gleeson and Dan Colley, and you can catch their production Bears in Space, written by Owen Quinn, at the Civic Theatre in Talla in Dublin tonight, or you can always follow them to the Edinburgh Festival. Nearbya is an award-winning play currently running at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunlera in County Dublin. The play was inspired by the gang rape of medical student Jyoti Singh Pandey on a bus in New Delhi 2 years ago. It features the testimonies of Indian women who've been the victim of sexual abuse. Bollywood actress Purna Jagannathan has herself been sexually assaulted, and she's one of the stars of the show. And she spoke with Ryan Tubridy on 2FM yesterday.
Jyoti Singh Pandey.
Jyoti Singh Pandey. Yes. And can you tell us her story?
Sure. She was a 23-year-old medical student who had just finished watching Life of Pi with a male friend, and she was on her way home, and they were unable to get a rickshaw. A bus stopped, it had tinted windows, so she and her male friend got on, and within minutes, it was clear that it was almost a trap. So there were six men on the bus, and they instigated a fight. They took Avindra, her friend, back to the bus and beat him with iron rods unconscious. And then they came in for her. They gang raped her, and they brutally assaulted her with iron rods, so much so that she was disemboweled. They threw them off the bus after stripping them naked, and for 2 hours they were on the street and no one stopped for them. And recently I went to that spot where they were thrown, and it's not a deserted place. There's cars coming. There's a restaurant opposite. There were people around who didn't stop.
Jyoti died of her injuries 13 days later, and apparently such assaults are common in India, where a new rape is reported every 20 minutes.
The shame is learnt. It's inherited. Culturally, both in India and both here and probably everywhere in the world, there's a very strong code of shame and a very strong code of silence. And so I learned that very early on. There's just a culture of very strong denial and not wanting to hear and not being either indifferent or apathetic or just not wanting to deal, which is the culture I grew up in.
Purna Jagannathan, and that play, Nearbya, runs at the Pavilion in Dunlera in Dublin all next week. The brilliant and sparky Irish Times columnist Miriam Lord found herself in the headlights this week when she took a swipe at the annual Patrick McGill Summer School in Glenties, County Donegal, which has been running very successfully, I might add, for the past 34 years. McGill's big thinkers, she wrote, keep asking the same questions at a festival frequented by retired civil servants and teachers. Ouch. Well, one wag quipped that Miriam had to get the early, early bus out of Dodge. But RTE's Sean O'Rourke stayed on and broadcast a very lively show from the summer school on Wednesday. One of his guests was former Taoiseach Mary Coughlan, who, with Taoiseach Brian Cowan and Finance Minister Brian Lenihan, presided over one of the most turbulent periods in Irish politics. Mary Coughlan wasn't in the room on that infamous night of the bank guarantee in September 2008, a decision which choked the life out of the country. But Sean and herself still raked over the coals of the subsequent implosion of Fianna Fáil.
Did you have any sense, and looking back now, that that particular government and that fateful decision to guarantee 100% of all bank deposits was going to be as fateful as it was?
Well, at the time, we were left with no decision or a decision. And we had to make a decision, and a decision that would have inevitably meant if we didn't make that decision, we would have had a more serious situation there and then. And, you know, now it's easier to speak about these things because things progressed over the years, and not just in Ireland, but all over the European Union. And we're still talking about these issues. So it's been a long-term impact, the recession on Europe and on the world. Our banks too big to fail? That was a consideration. We had Northern Rock, what was going to happen as a consequence of that. Our big concern was what was going to happen to the people of Ireland as a consequence of getting up in the morning and there was going to be no money in the ATM machines. So, you know, a decision was made and as you know, there were inquiries made subsequently which indicated that at the time there was very little choice for the government but to make such a decision.
Well, that's disputed, I suppose. And what maybe you were misled about, if not lied to, was the state of the banks.
Well, we certainly weren't informed.
Who do you blame for that?
Once you have full information, you can make a full decision, but a decision was made on the basis of the information that was made available to the government.
If you had known the problem was one of solvency as well as liquidity, do you think Anglo would have been let go?
I'm not going to answer that. I think that would be most imprudent, given that, you know, there's going to be a few more court cases and there's going to be a banking inquiry. So let's await the outcome.
Do you think
those.
You'll have much to tell that inquiry yourself?
I shouldn't think so. If I'm asked to be there, I'll be there.
Former Thánaiste Mary Coughlan. Well, the appointment of Fine Gael TD Joe McHugh as junior minister for the Gaeltacht caused controversy recently because of his lack of fluency in Irish. He's since been attending classes and seems to be doing just fine.
But taking lessons, how are they going?
Going good, yeah. I must say, Eduscale and Glencolum Kill is a great spot. And while I'm learning, I goes like Fulham's and Rang, Vime Canch, Linadini, ask Glencolum Kill, August Vime Geistacht, August. To make bunch le saltas. I'm enjoying myself.
August Vitunan, Agla Vienna, Red and Gueltic, and Shacht and Shakacha Nakro.
Yeah, look, Shema Hurum, like it's in my opinion, Shema Hurum tan and Bohr Fada, Tame Egober, August Tame Mon Mojihil. I'm at the start of my journey towards improving it. And while the language is obviously the talking point, it's the Gaeltacht portfolio that I'm following, immersing myself into, briefing myself on, and plus the natural resources, which is a wide brief, including from oil exploration to mining to fracking.
Minister Joe McHugh in Glenties. Well, Niall O'Hanagan has become a bit of a patha on the Today Show ever since he won the Poetry Aloud competition. He too was in Glenties, and he recited Seamus Heaney's poem, Postscript.
And sometime, make the time to drive out west into County Clare, along the flaggy shore, in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones, the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earthed lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting are busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there. A hurry through which known and strange things pass. As big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
Niall O'Hanagan and a poem by the late Seamus Heaney, who was remembered at the McGill Summer School in Glenties. The gulf of understanding in the Middle East has never been more clearly on show than in the past week. As the death toll escalated and the merciless bombings continued, talk on the airwaves on both sides remained in parallel lines. Professor Mads Gilbert is an emergency services surgeon in Shifa Hospital in Gaza, and on Morning Ireland, he told of the daily carnage he and his colleagues have to deal with.
The shelling has been continuous, almost continuous, uninterrupted bombing by F-16 and by drones and from the sea shelling. So we've heard the explosions and the detonation has shaken the ground, and it's not a pleasant place to be.
And what sort of injuries are you seeing?
The most important and most striking thing is, of course, that the overwhelming majority of the injured are civilians, women and children, almost none fighters at all. We're seeing amputations, fragment injuries, burns, decapitations, people who are torn totally apart. Everyone is scared because the bombing is so fierce and the destruction being so overwhelming that you feel, of course, extremely helpless. Many of those who come in as patients, you know, maybe have lost the whole family. So it's an extremely painful situation to receive those wounded in the emergency room. And many of the children have injuries that we have to do a lot of sort of surgical procedures without taking them to the operating room, because we simply don't have capacity in the operating room to do everything there. So we have to do it in makeshift dressing rooms and in local anesthesia.
Is the hospital able to cope with the number of people who are now being brought into you?
The amazing thing about the Palestinian people is that they never yield, they never give up. They find ways to cope, and yes, it is coping.
But Israel's ambassador to Ireland, Boaz Modai, told Gavin Jennings that Israel's understanding of the situation is very different.
2 days ago, Israel built a field hospital to help wounded civilians from Gaza, just near the Erez crossing. We do that because we care about the Palestinians much more than Hamas cares about them.
If you care about Palestinians, why have you just bombed a hospital in Gaza?
I don't know to which thing you're referring to, but you have to understand that the biggest bunker of the Hamas is under the largest hospital, Shifa Hospital in Gaza. And we are doing our utmost not to hit civilians, but we should understand that every civilian that dies as a result of this violence was murdered by the Hamas. What the Hamas is doing is a genocide against their own people. We should understand that. I know that people in the West find it very difficult to understand how come they want their people to be killed. But the Hamas is doing a double war crime. They shoot at civilians and they hide behind their civilians who serve as human shields. And for them, any casualty is a victory. If it's an Israeli, that's good. And if it's a Palestinian, it's PR victory.
Ambassador, even if your claim is true that rockets are being hid close to a hospital, how does that justify hitting a hospital?
I really don't know to which case you're referring to.
The hospital in Gaza that was hit in the last 48 hours.
I don't know. Which hospital? I really don't know the details about that one, but I can assure you that if something like that happened, it wasn't intentional, that these things, you should understand, can happen. One should realize that it's a battlefield is something, if you haven't experienced that, you are lucky, because it's a very ugly place and the terrible things can happen there and a lot of mistakes. If Israel wanted really just to kill Palestinians, why would we put our soldiers in danger and almost 30 of them were already killed? We could have just bombed them from the air.
Just in case you weren't aware, it's the Al-Aqsa Hospital which was hit. Israeli tanks hit the Al-Aqsa Hospital on Monday, killing 4 patients and 1 medic in the hospital.
Again, I mean, you can bring different examples. I don't know about this one in particular, but it doesn't matter. The fact is that what we do is we do all the in our power not to hit civilians, not to hit schools and mosques. And in these mosques, for example, the Hamas hides their missiles. Only 2 days ago, or 3 days ago, UNRWA revealed that 20 missiles were hidden in a school of UNRWA. They break every rule that exists. We are trying to do the opposite.
How can you do your best not to target civilians in a tiny area where 2 million people are living?
Exactly. This is why it is so complicated and difficult. Do we have any other choice? Are we supposed to let every hour two missiles to land in Israel?
Whatever the differing interpretations, the net result is unbearable human suffering. On Thursday, there was an attack on a United Nations shelter. 15 people died when the Israeli Defence Forces hit the school in Beit Hanun. Israeli spokesman Mark Regev gave this explanation.
We've been warning people to leave that facility for 2-3 days now. We did it through the UN, we did it through the Red Cross, because we knew Hamas was exploiting that facility for its own terrorist machine. We urge people to leave. There are reports that Hamas prevented people from leaving.
But Robert Turner, the head of the UN Relief and Works Agency, which runs the facility, refuted this.
The Israeli Foreign Ministry is insisting that a window was put in place and was agreed.
That's simply inaccurate. Yesterday, we had decided that the situation was becoming too dangerous. We had requested a window during which it would be safe for our staff to withdraw. We were telling the displaced that we were leaving and why we were leaving, but that window was never granted.
Is there any possibility that a mistake was made here? Because UN facilities are quite clearly identifiable visually using blue paint and tend to be white walls with with blue strips around them, and also the coordinates of such facilities would be made known. Do you believe there's any possibility a mistake was made?
I think we need an investigation into what happened yesterday, but this is the fourth incident of a strike directly on one of our schools in 4 days. We had a strike on a school on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, and again yesterday. You know, that's a trend.
Robert Turner of UNRWA with Fran McNulty on yesterday's Morning Ireland. Well, I was listening to Éan Ó-Riordan, the new Minister of State for Justice, on Wednesday, and he says reform of the direct provision system, under which asylum seekers can spend up to 9 years waiting on a decision with no right to work or study, will be a top priority for him. He spoke with Rachel English.
What are your main concerns about the system as it currently operates?
Well, essentially we have a system which has 34 provision centres. Within those centres there's about 4,300 residents. 1,700 of those are children. And of those, about 59% have been there for over 3 years, 31% for over 5 years, and 9% for more than 7 years. So I think anybody would agree that that sort of a system is intolerable. These centres are overseen by the Reception and Integration Agency, who look at health and safety inspections and so on. But I think that if you have a child who's been in a centre like this for 9 years, I think any civilised society will suggest that that's just not good enough. And so in the statement of government priorities that was agreed between Labour and Fine Gael this summer, there is a commitment to reform the system.
Minister Éan Ó-Riordan. And in his radio diary for Drive Time, Joe O'Connor imagines the Taoiseach in 2034 having to make a public apology for the system.
My fellow citizens, this is your Taoiseach speaking, and I'm going to ask for your focused attention. It is an unusual step, I know, for the Taoiseach to address you directly, but at this moment, on the eve of 2034, the level of public disquiet about the recent tribunal findings has provoked widespread upset and unease. I speak, of course, of the Tribunal on Direct Provision for Asylum Seekers, the report of which has just been published. I am as shocked as you are. The system of so-called direct provision was deeply wrong. It is horrifying to know that vulnerable people in Ireland were treated as they were in the early decades of this century, given an allowance of 19 euros on which to survive for a week, refused permission to work, belittled and disrespected, kept long-term in inadequate and institutional accommodation never designed for the purpose, whole families sharing a room, parents forbidden to parent, human beings who came to this country in the desperate search for freedom, told when to eat and to wash. Some of the testimonies of these vulnerable people, among the poorest in the whole world, would break a heart. You've heard them. But it's important that we don't judge what seem to be the errors of the past by the higher moral standards of today. Back then, the Irish people didn't know what was going on, and their government was distracted by more important matters than basic human rights, such as commemorating the 1913 lockout, the First World War, Countess Markovitch's first date, and of course the Easter Rising. You will of course remember the Easter Rising with its commitment to cherishing all the children equally. Terms and conditions apply, not the African children, of course. To us, from our vantage point of hindsight, which is 2020 vision, it seems a savage irony that any society would be so gruesomely fixated on the events of the past, while weak and frightened people were being treated so shamefully. But it must be remembered that the people of 2014 were upset by the revelations of their own time, for example, women and children being treated harshly in residential institutions. Yes, Ireland in 2014 came out bravely against unkindness, provided it was all in the past. They were also focused on the things that really mattered, the ancient Celtic ritual of moving round of political personnel, known in those days as a cabinet reshuffle, and of course the vitally important question of whether or not the country and western musician Garth Brooks would gig in Ireland. I offer a heartfelt apology to all survivors of the direct provision system. It should never have happened and will never happen again. Steps are being taken so that redress can now be made. Too late, I know, but better late than never, if better isn't putting it too strong.
Joe O'Connor's radio diary, heard on Wednesday's Drive Time with Audrey Carville. Well, stress is one of the buzzwords of the 21st century, and there's no doubt that there's a lot of it about these days. Dealish Clare is a GP and a medical herbalist, and she outlined the main causes of stress to Sean O'Rourke.
acute stress is particularly brought on by bereavement, relationship change, being in love, being dumped, being divorced, change, moving house or going on holiday. But I would say the commonest reason for stress is just overload. We're trying to do too much on too many different levels of concentration. We can cope with 6 out of 10 of them, 8 out of 10 on a good day, but constantly dealing with 8 to 10, we're just not designed for. It's like living in a field with a bull. We're constantly aware, alert, maybe not sleeping too well. An interesting one that I've observed in clinical practice is that sometimes when we're very happy, we actually get very worried. As in, you know, when you're in love, you get that feeling of edgy, you know, maybe this is too good. But mostly I would say the stress is a state of mind. And that expectation of happiness is a stress. We shouldn't expect to be happy. We should expect to be content.
And this is what the doctor ordered.
Herbs work better on the mild to moderate. If you're stressed up to your eyeballs with severe panic attacks, you need a collaborative approach. You need counselling, you might need a little bit of the stress medicine, but the herbs are best with the mild to moderate. And particularly if you want to use them over the counter and in the absence of professional advice. For moderate to severe, you would really need to see a medical herbalist. But the herbs that are lovely, the relaxing ones, are chamomile, lavender, vervain. Vervain is very suited to Irish people. It has a liver nervine edge to it. It was a sacred herb of the Druids. Lime flower and passiflora, which is slightly sedating. Rosemary, which is good for painful memories. But the nice thing about using the herbs is you don't use just one at a time. You also use muscle relaxants like elderflower and cramp bark, because we also get tight in the shoulders and our jaw gets tight. And you also use heart stamina herbs like hawthorn. And there are two herbs that are particularly good for anxiety, and they would be valerian and skullcap. And in a blend, I would always use digestive herbs, because the state of your digestion and the state of your brain chemistry are very closely interlinked. And then directly nourishing and stamina for the nervous system is wild oats. You know the expression to sow your wild oats?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where that came from.
Dr. Dealish Clare, GP and medical herbalist, heard on Wednesday. Well, stay tuned for Richard Curran. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news with the business. But I'll leave you now with the song from Anya Brune, which I heard on the John Creedon Show. Tamisha Eglocka Sira, Ach Bay Fiona Kelly on Shalev and Tachtan Jahogin, Kijishin, Bonagi Saltas and Law, Agaska Jeshub Slan.
You with the sad eyes. Don't be discouraged, though I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all, but the darkness inside you can make you feel so small. And I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors. And that's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors, true colors, true colors are beautiful like a rainbow. Show me a smile then. Don't be unhappy, can't remember when I last saw you laughing. If this world makes you crazy and you're taking all you can, then you call me up because you know I'll be there. And I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors, and that's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors, true colors.